Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our next edition of the SPME BDS Monitor Live. I'd like to welcome you this afternoon for our latest discussion with the editor of our BDS Monitor, Dr. Alex Jaffe, once again is joining us to have some discussion about the latest trends and events that we are seeing regarding the BDS movement at large. Both of us, actually, myself and Alex, just returned from the APAC policy conference, which many of these issues were discussed and addressed as it relates to current trends in American politics. And we'll be discussing that this afternoon, as well as trends going forward as a result of the upcoming Israeli elections on April 9th, the latest events that happened in Netanyahu's visit now to Washington, and of course, the back and forth about U.S.-Israel relations in the larger landscape of the BDS movement at large. A few housekeeping issues before we start, as always. Those of you who've logged in through the computer, you will see an icon of a hand. Once we are done our conversation, we welcome as many questions as possible. Should you have a question, please click on that icon, and I will be able to unmute you and be able to ask your question. You also may write your question in through the system, and I'll be able to read your question and we can answer them. As always, if you have questions after the call and you have not been able to ask your question, you could always email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org. Again, bdsmonitor@spme.org. So without further ado, again, welcome. Alex, welcome again for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thanks again to everybody for attending on this bright, sunny spring day here in the East. And I should note that this month's BDS Monitor, which will be coming out, I guess, at the weekend or the very beginning of next week, we'll touch on many of the issues that I want to talk about today. So I apologize for any repetition that is coming your way. It was a very consequential month for BDS, and I've tried to emphasize over the last at least a year and a half, that part of the function of the BDS movement on campus has been to normalize and to mainstream the concept of boycotting Israel, delegitimizing Israel, and to move that from the campus and associated wings into the political mainstream. And there can be no doubt that this is a mainstream political problem now. But let's start with the campus, because there are a couple of very interesting and, I think, consequential sorts of developments this past month. Everybody is aware of the situation at Pitzer College, one of the five schools out at Claremont, where a joint faculty-student body voted to end its study abroad program at the University of Haifa. And this was a very, obviously, contested process with all sorts of the very typical kinds of shenanigans that accompany a BDS movement in student government or in faculty spheres like academic associations. And this was no exception. What's important, I think, out of this development is to see that there is now real faculty leadership within institutions themselves pushing BDS in one form or another. The guy who's a professor of anthropology, I think, at Pitzer, when he was questioned a number of weeks ago about why Israel, he said, well, there are all sorts of human rights abuses in the world and all sorts of bad places that do bad things, but Israel is a good place to start by making a stand for human rights, so to speak. So really, it's the same kind of deflection that we see all over in every sphere related to BDS, that yes, things are bad all over, but we're going to concentrate on one place and one place only, and that's Israel. The other thing that is important to note about Pitzer, as it is really in all situations where BDS resolutions are discussed by faculty and especially by students, is that the university president, college president in this case, even before the vote took place, stated that the institution would not be going along with whatever the faculty decided about a boycott. And this has set up yet another level of confrontation between the faculty and the students. And we saw also this month that Swarthmore and Brown, students voted in favor of BDS resolutions, one via a referendum at Brown and one within student government at Swarthmore, which was actually a re-vote. They didn't get the right outcome the first time, so they voted again, is how it seems. And in both of those cases, the university presidents have said that it's not going to happen, that the university will not be divesting or boycotting in any way. But the consequences of a student administration confrontation are, I think, much more limited than the potential consequences, let's say, of a faculty administration confrontation. And we don't know how this is going to play out. I think there's a kind of parallel case, or this is an extension, you might say, of the situation we saw a few months back in the fall with the University of Michigan instructors. And that situation, the instructors who refused to write letters of recommendation for students who wanted to study abroad in Israel. And this set up a confrontation between the individual student, the individual faculty members, excuse me, and the administration. And when the threat of sanctions was dangled against these faculty members, one newly tenured, one was an instructor, actually, that's when the faculty really got involved. And the faculty became indignant that anyone would try and sanction, the administration would try and sanction another faculty member for the exercise of free speech, so to speak. And I think that this brings in all sorts of questions about faculty governance and university governance and who is in charge that we will see played out in the months and years to come. It also, I think, is important because it's another indication that there is a small, hardcore minority of faculty members who really, really hate Israel and really want to push BDS wherever they can, within their institution or within academic associations. We've certainly seen that many times in the past. And sooner or later, one of these characters is going to become a dean or a provost, and maybe even someday a university president. And to date, out of something like 150 boycott resolutions that have been proposed over the last 15 or so years, none have passed, many have passed rather, something like 65% have passed, but none have been implemented because the administrations have been the bulwark against this move. Someday, I think, it will be possible that a major university or a minor college or an administrator somewhere will actually go along. And then we'll see what happens. Then we'll have a very interesting situation. All of these developments, I think, play into larger kinds of confrontations and patterns of alienation that are emerging between faculty and students, between faculty and administrators, between students and administrators, and most importantly, in a sense, between universities and higher education as a concept and the public. And we saw this at Evergreen State with the rioting there. We saw this at the University of Missouri with the rioting there, the Black Lives Matter related confrontations. The aftermath of these has been for alumni and for state legislators and for the general community to become alienated from the institutions, for enrollments to drop, for state appropriations to drop. And this is just the market at work. I don't think we've reached a real tipping point for the industry, the higher education industry as a whole. But and that's, I think, in part because university administrators and presidents have been holding the line. But we'll see. We'll see how long these things, how long these patterns continue. There's another BDS resolution that's being considered by the student government at Cornell. And there, it will coincide with the election of a new student government, student government leadership. And the candidates for these positions have already been queried by student media and other folks about where they stand on this issue. So this is an electoral issue, apparently, not something that just comes up. And the president of Cornell has already said it's not going to happen, but it shows that these kinds of attitudes and behaviors and have been institutionalized, have been normalized, and the delegitimization of Israel and of Zionism and of Israelis and of Jews and others who support Israel is becoming very deeply rooted within higher educational institutional life. So the other thing, and again, I want to stress that, at least in my view, this is the extension, this is the logical extension, this is the intended consequence of BDS on campus, has been to move this into the political arena. We've seen BDS, obviously, in churches. We've seen it in labor unions. We've seen it in city councils. But now we see it in Congress. And there is what I have called, only slightly tongue-in-cheek, a BDS caucus in Congress. Ilhan Omar, Rashid Tlaib, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the face of the Democratic insurgents against the old guard. Rashida expressed her support for the Pitzer vote before it took place. And I think this is a very interesting direct connection. She has no connection with the institution. It's in a different state. It's obviously not her district. But she will support it wherever she finds it. The big BDS / anti-Semitism controversy of this past month was obviously Ilhan Omar's tweets about suggesting that members of Congress who support Israel and vote in favor of Israel-related legislation are enthralled to dual loyalties, and which she implied in another tweet were all about the Benjamins, that they were being paid off. And this started the ball rolling, excuse me, about this ultimately completely nonsensical anti-hate resolution, non-binding resolution. Obviously, that was passed by the House, where an anti-Semitism resolution that condemned her and her attitudes and statements specifically was in very rapid course watered down into an all-purpose condemnation of hate as an emotion, as a sentiment, as a behavior, I suppose. And this came on the eve of the big AIPAC policy conference, which just wrapped up yesterday in Washington at during which was very interesting. So her tweets and the kerfuffle about the resolution and all this took place, I guess it was about 3 weeks ago, two and a half weeks ago. And the Democratic leadership really got steamrolled by these young insurgents. On the other hand, I was told at the AIPAC policy conference that as a response to this specific crisis, that several thousand additional people signed up to go to AIPAC from progressive democratic kinds of orientations. And we've begun to see articles in various newspapers about how left-wing Democrats, progressive Democrats, and Jewish Democrats are suddenly very nervous about the stance that their party has implicitly or explicitly taken, and that for the first time they're going to think about voting Republican. And at this point, I should repeat the normal boilerplate that SPME is not a partisan organization. It's not Republican. It's not Democrat. It doesn't take position on parties or anything. But I'm sort of calling it, calling out who I see behaving in which way, in this particular situation. So at AIPAC, and for those of you who've not been, there are 18,000 people attending, and it's a 100 ring circus of very large meetings and speeches by politicians and very small breakout sessions about specific topics. In virtually all of the large sessions, politicians from both parties spoke and condemned anti-Semitism, condemned anti-Zionism, condemned the BDS movement, and this came from Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer in the House. It came, interestingly, from Bill de Blasio, speaking specifically as a progressive, Democratic mayor of New York, really the closest as a sort of socialist, he's closest to the insurgents with respect to economic policy, as well as by a number of Republicans, not least of all Nikki Haley and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who said explicitly that, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. You couldn't manufacture a more unified kind of display against the BDS movement, a unified series of statements. Now, it's true that Vice President Mike Pence did explicitly say, and I don't have his words in front of me, that the Democratic Party is becoming the party of anti-Semitism. And that's making a political assertion, obviously. But with respect to BDS, everybody was pretty much on the same page, and this is logical because this is the audience that you're talking to. And I think that Omar may have gotten the message because she tweeted rather petulantly, and all of their social media have a kind of juvenile petulant character to it, I must say, that she was sorry to hear Nancy Pelosi trying to shut down or denigrate the free exercise of free speech. And this is on the part of the BDS movement. And this is their shtick, you might say, or one of them, that BDS is simply the exercise of free speech, and it's not discrimination on the basis of ethnic or national origin, and that economic behavior like boycotting, divesting on the part of institutions like colleges is simply the free exercise of speech rather than discrimination. So it's been a very interesting couple of weeks, and I don't really know what to make of it. I've been very disheartened in the wake of the initial crisis and the initial response in the form of the House resolution, which was so meaningless. And it really did seem as though the House leadership, which is obviously much older, which obviously has a broader series of interests and responsibilities, was getting steamrolled. And I wrote a few things about that. I wonder now whether the old folks, so to speak, are pushing back. And it's really going to be all about the follow-through from this point onward. Whose party is it? Now, it's also useful to point at the Republican response that the House Senate Democrats have introduced legislation condemning anti-Semitism, which mentions the BDS movement specifically as an anti-Semitic phenomenon, and parallel legislation has been introduced by House Republicans as well, condemning anti-Semitism and the kinds of dual loyalties accusations that Omar made specifically. So we'll see where it goes, because they'll have to, everybody, Republicans and Democrats, will have to get on the record about this by voting for it or not voting for it. So we'll see. That will be a much more, I think, interesting and meaningful test than simply getting up in front of a bunch of people and making a speech. So I'd like to be cautiously hopeful about the future of the party, the Democratic Party, but we'll see how this plays out going forward. Obviously, and as I say every time we have one of these calls, the counterpoint is the crisis in the British Labour Party, where now the Human Rights Council, the equivalent national level Human Rights Council, has opened up an investigation of the Labour Party and its massive, undeniable, ridiculous anti-Semitism crisis. So we'll see whether British politics are self-correcting. American politics have self-correcting kinds of tendencies and mechanisms. We'll see how it works out in Britain. There are a number of other, excuse me, developments here and there. And let me just see if there's anything else that's worth mentioning. Maybe this is a good place to leave it, actually. There's a whole other series of issues related to how, in the wake of the horrific massacre in New Zealand at the two mosques, how criticism of Islam and of BDS specifically is being ruled out of bounds by BDS supporters and Islamists. But let's leave that for another time. I discussed that a little bit in a couple paragraphs in the upcoming Monitor. And let's see if people have questions and we can talk about some of these issues.
Wonderful. Thank you, Alex, as always, for the comprehensive analysis of a very complicated and ongoing unraveling landscape of issues that we tackle all the time here at SPME, and this is obviously a lot of concerns and a lot of issues going forward politically and culturally in general. So with that being said, obviously we brought up a lot of issues here. The floor is now open, so again, just to go with some housekeeping issues, you can click on the icon or write us a question, and I will, if you have a question like to ask, please raise your hand virtually and I will unmute you. If you have a question, I will read your question, and then you can go from there. I believe we have a few questions here. So let me start with Daniel Lowe's question, Alex, and I will read it.
Okay.
And so the question is, Daniel was in Germany. So the observation that Daniel was making here in Germany, we have the hard left and the Greens, SPD, acting under the cover of BDS as a third rail in Germany, but they're active in the background. And then so he's asking, what is Omar and company doing? Is moving to the overtone in general as a result of that?
Well, Ocasio-Cortez is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. So
at one point he was saying, here, you know, again, to the AOC, that he has not heard pro-BDS standpoint. So,
from her, she's equivocated. That's very true. But she will defend her two compatriots at every turn. So her precise attitudes about this aren't really very clear. On the other hand, as a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, their position is explicitly clear. Their position is explicitly in favor of BDS. They voted on this at their party rally or party congress, whatever it is, last year. And to the extent that they are a growing force in American politics, both at the local level and maybe even at the national level, this is a real concern. So in Seattle, there is a real Democratic Socialist presence on the city council, and in Portland as well. And for this reason, BDS gets raised regularly in those venues. It makes very little sense with respect to the politics and concerns of these communities, but that's how it works. And I think, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, that as of 3 or 4 years ago, the numbers of the members of the Democratic Socialists, there were something like 10 or 12,000. Now the number is up to 30 or 40,000. So there is a kind of national expansion. Is this really significant? Is it really affecting national politics? Well, not a day goes by when you don't see an article someplace either praising or damning AOC for being the de facto leader of the House. So we'll have to see about that. The Green Party in America, which is still very small, is also explicitly in favor of BDS. There is a Communist Party, but I don't know much about what they're doing. I don't pay much attention to them. I would have a feeling that this is just the kind of issue that they would get behind. So, certainly from the far left, there is there's a Democratic Socialist sort of caucus in the Chicago City Council now, as well. Chicago has its own unique political system, as we know, as well as its law enforcement system, its legal system, distinct from the rest of the country. But there's a major faction there. So I think we're going to see how these kinds of issues play out, where we know that socialists generally in Europe, and certainly the Greens in Europe, are not pro-Israel, and we know that they've made very strong alliances, and increasingly here with Islamist parties. So during AIPAC this past weekend, Omar was in Los Angeles doing a fundraiser for the local branches of CARE, which is basically the American Muslim Brotherhood front organization. So this is, in Europe, this is called the Red-Green Alliance, the far left and the Islamists. And I think we have the same scenario that has developed here. It's still fairly small scale. It's still localized, in a sense, to particular districts and in particular states. But it's a growing concern. And certainly the Socialists and the Greens, we know where they stand. And AOC, we'll see where she stands.
Thank you. Let's go on to Adriana here. Sorry. Can you hear us? Andrea? Can you hear us? Hello, can you hear us? Okay. Maybe the audio is not working. Apologize for that. If you can hear us, you are unmuted. You can ask your question. Okay. Let's try another one. We'll try to come back. You can hear us. Daniel, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
I'm just listening at the moment. I have the sort of the European perspective a little bit, and specifically here in Germany. And I just typed in your comment section that as an example, the German Green Party has a party foundation. And they have been giving a lot of money, which NGO Monitor has recorded, to Israeli BDS activists, you know, and their supporters, just as an example. And the German Communist Party, Die Linke, does the same. They also funnel money to hardcore left-wing activists in Israel and, yes, in Judea and Samaria.
Well, this is one of the things that NGO Monitor has really pioneered, and that's exposing how political parties and NGOs have been at the forefront of supporting BDS both locally and in Israel and in Palestinian territories. I think it's important, one of the important things to emphasize about that kind of relationship, the NGOs in Europe generally work differently than in the States. NGOs in Europe are, to a much greater extent, funded by the government. That the philanthropic sector in European society and the concept of philanthropy in European society is very different, and it gets run through. Philanthropy gets run through unaccountable NGOs in almost every European country, maybe with the exception of Britain, and various government departments give money to churches, give money to NGOs run by labor unions, give money to standalone NGOs, which then recycle taxpayer money, essentially, to whatever causes they feel they wish to support. And I'm forgetting what the numbers are specifically, but we're talking in the tens of millions of dollars to support BDS. In the States, it works a little bit differently because the NGO sector here is by and large not supported by government funds, that is to say taxpayer funds. It's much more standalone, and there's a tradition the way American American culture has developed really since the very beginning is that charity is much more of an individual kind of enterprise, and philanthropy as a scaled up extension of that is much more individualized. What we find here is that, in contrast to Europe, major foundations tend to be captured after their founders leave the scene, a generation or so later, tend to be captured by professional staff. And there is a revolving door between the staffs of foundations and between the staffs of NGOs and the staff and media outlets, and the same kinds of left-wing, let's say, tendencies emerge where the big example, the classic example, the horrifying example is the Rockefeller Fund, Rockefeller Brothers Fund, which provides enormous support to Jewish Voice for Peace and to other BDS groups in the States and overseas. And this has been exposed, this has been discussed, and they're good with it. So, and what we haven't really analyzed, to my knowledge, no one has analyzed, the relationship between left-wing political parties getting support, where they get their support from in the United States. Where does the money for the Greens come from? Where does the money for Democratic Socialists come from? And how does that relate to foundation funding and other sources? But the result, the results are the process is different, but the results are very similar. Is that far left parties and NGOs are almost uniformly supportive of BDS and are very frank about it. So,
thank you, Daniel. Appreciate the question and especially joining us from Europe. Let's try Andrea again here, see if she is curious at this point. And Andrea, can you hear us? Can you hear us? Okay. We will continue to try. Again, we apologize for any technological issues. If you can, feel free to email us or ask the question through the system as well. As I'm looking for more questions here, Alex, the one point I think that, you know, obviously you implied and touched on, but again, I think it's worth kind of diving into a little bit for a few minutes, you know, for a little bit, is just, you know, the upcoming Israeli elections coming up.
Oh, right.
April 9th. And I think that obviously each one, well, Prime Minister Netanyahu had to return as a result of the latest events. The attacks in Israel, so he was not at AIPAC in person, but Benny Gantz, the Blue and White Party, was there. These were a lot of the conversations going on, and I think it's a touch on that. And of course, if you could also make, you know, talk about, you know, the latest statement that came out as far as Israeli sovereignty over the Golan, does that also impact some of the conversation that we're seeing here? Clearly, Omar and others have commented on all this, so if you can touch on that as well, too.
Right. Okay, well, with respect to the elections, again, the same caution has to be in place that SPME takes no position on this. I think SPME wants somebody to be elected cleanly and democratically, and to unite the country to move forward, whoever that's.
We're not getting into local Israeli politics or American politics, but, you know, obviously the observations and, you know, the left and right, you know, and of course, you know, the state of Israel at large.
Right. It's a complicated business. It's frankly a dirty business, Israeli elections. One point I think that's worth emphasizing is that in the BDS movement and on the left generally, And even in parts of the center of American political opinion and world political opinion, the figure of Benjamin Netanyahu is unique. Very few people are demonized the way that Netanyahu is. And this is something that predates the election of President Trump. Certainly the association of Trump and Netanyahu is now fixed, both, I think, by their choice and by default. I'm sorry. That these are two characters, two personalities with all sorts of similarities, but many more differences, who are just uniquely demonized in political circles. And this process of hearing the name Netanyahu and frothing at the mouth has been an impediment for many years towards dispassionate analytical thinking about the individual, his policies, and the future. And I would argue the same goes for Trump. So the BDS movement and people like Omar have been focused on Netanyahu as if he is somehow uniquely responsible for the continued presence of Israel in the West Bank, or for some kind of warlike tendencies towards Gaza, towards Lebanon, towards Syria. And I think that that's frankly incorrect. Whatever you think about him as an individual and as a leader, polls indicate that many of his policies are represent a kind of broad consensus, not absolute by any means, but more than half of the electorate in Israel supports these kinds of policies, if only because nobody's come up with anything better, and because the outcome of the Oslo process, in the sense of the terror camp, the Palestinian terror campaigns of a decade ago, profoundly traumatized the Israeli population. And the blue and white party represented by Gantz and Lapid, from what I can tell, doesn't have a particularly novel set of policies with respect to these kinds of issues. And it'll be interesting to see whether, if Gantz and his cohort are elected, whether they're demonized the same way that Netanyahu has been. I'm not so sure. The rise of the BDS movement to where it is today has largely partially coincided with Netanyahu's tenure as Israeli prime minister, which is the longest in Israeli history. So it's tempting to see to suggest that there's some kind of causal relationship, but I don't know that that's really the case. I don't know how we would test that, except maybe by Israeli citizens voting Netanyahu out and voting somebody else in. So we'll have to see about that. Now, as far as the Golan goes, this is a very new development of this week, although it's been coming for a couple of weeks. I don't see a lot yet in the BDS movement's literature or statements regarding the American recognition of Israeli annexation of the Golan as a kind of talking point. This may be coming. We'll have to see. And you know, the implications of this annexation, of this recognition of annexation, may be that someplace down the line that that an Israeli government under somebody's leadership could try and annex the major settlement blocks or other pieces of real estate, or possibly even the entire West Bank. We don't know. And the and how American recognition or non-recognition would play into that is obviously premature to discuss. We do know that as of, I think it's this afternoon, that the United Nations Security Council will rouse itself to meet and discuss this this latest challenge that it's been confronted with. And I believe it was France who called the meeting.
Yes.
So we'll see how, we know how that'll play out. That's pretty much transparent. I don't think they'll be too happy with it. But we'll see. But with respect to BDS specifically, I haven't seen it yet, but certainly if it came up, certainly anything with respect to the, you know, the West Bank settlement blocks, then we would see the BDS movement talking about it big time.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Talia here. Talia has a question. Let me see if I can unmute Talia. Talia, can you hear us? Talia, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please ask your question.
Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. And thank you so much for your work. I've been concerned for a while, a long time actually, that you know, academics and people who are documenting all of this are, you know, doing good work in that, which of course is very important. However, 20 years ago, I was in Israel at the time of the Second Intifada, and I had a cousin who was in media, and I said to him at that point, from what I was seeing and feeling, I said, you know, we might be able to win a ground war, but we're losing the propaganda war. And media has much more impact than all our analysis or facts or figures or you know. And unfortunately, I was looking at Al Jazeera, for example, this morning. And And the reason I was looking at Al Jazeera is because, and I've been an environmentalist for a long time, and I've seen the creeping, you know, kind of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism in that movement, which has, you know, shocked me. Almost everywhere you go in social justice and all of this, you're seeing this. I'm from Canada. And, you know, and it's impossible to fight because it's you know, it's a received wisdom. You know, if you move from one group to another that you trust, this is it. Unless you're a Jew and an Israeli and been following all of this, you really don't have a way to debate it, and it gets more and more complicated. So, what's your thoughts on two fronts? One is unifying all the various groups, whether it's Scholars for Peace in the Middle East and Honest Reporting, or, you know, the various groups that are watching and documenting this and doing some action here and there, and also creating a media channel. And I'm sorry, I'll get back to one more thing. I know I'm rambling because that's kind of the way I think. But I was watching Al Jazeera because I happened to go to an environmental site, which is very well respected, you know, on biomimicry and bioneers and all these people I associated with for many years. And below it was, you know, even more links to Al Jazeera and so on. And then I went on Al Jazeera, and while they have some fluff piece about Saudi Arabian design, below it is a continuous stream, new stream about Israel. And this is now, you know, an accepted news source. Doesn't matter that it's a propaganda arm. You know, it's like you can't fight it with facts and reality. And there's no kind of media counter to this, you know? So I'm just wondering about that. Is there somewhere somebody who's like a news source that's alternative and that will incorporate, you know, the things that people care about, like social justice and environment, and isn't, and is going to question all of this kind of infiltration by these Islamist propagandists? And the last thing is, too, how are we going to call out, because this was another thing I got from a top environmentalist who is Jewish, and a lot of them are, you know, that 30 voices or 30 Jewish groups, you know, are, you know, pro-Omar and so on and so forth. But there's never a mainstream opinion that is gone to, you know, it's these fringe groups, or you can call them fringe. It's increasingly becoming mainstream within certain circles, but there is no mainstream, you know, Israeli or Jewish opinion that gets a voice, that gets an outlet in a serious way.
Thank you. Okay. Well, let me see if I can unpack this a little and talk about at least a few of your points. With respect to the question of unifying groups and unifying voices, the reality is that this will not happen, and that it's never happened, and that, you know, Asaf and I have been in this space for many, many years, and we've seen groups come, we've seen groups go, we've proposed coming together with other groups, and so on, and it's just the nature of the nonprofit world, and it's also unfortunately the nature of the Jewish world that these kinds of things don't happen. That's the negative side. The positive side, I think, is that there is an advantage to swarming from different sides, from different positions, from different locations, as opposed to some kind of unified response that is very difficult to orchestrate, and that if you're talking about bias in the media, let's say, you have groups like Camera, you have groups like Honest Reporting, you have individuals in different communities who are responding. If you're talking about information sources, you have those same groups, you have other groups like Daily Alert from the Council Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, all and lots of others who provide critical resources, which at the end of the day do not amount to even a drop in the bucket of the budget of something like Al Jazeera, which is obviously a Qatari propaganda outlet that is widespread all over the world. So maybe, hopefully, we can put this in terms of a kind of David and Goliath sort of effort, that you know, we're the Davids throwing lots of little stones, and they're the behemoths. Some of them are the behemoths, like the Goliaths. And certainly, if we look these days at how Qatari influence is understood in Washington, really for the first time in the last few months, that, you know, Al Jazeera and Qatar and the royal family and the fact that America has its most important military base in the Middle East there, these are understood for the first time as profound, profound problems. What we're going to do with that, I don't know, because too many people are... There's too much money sloshing around, and too many people are dependent on that money. So that's one thing, or two things. With respect to your comment about the pervasiveness of BDS and anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, in environmentalism and environmental circles, this doesn't surprise me at all. You find it absolutely everywhere. You find it in English departments. You find it in nursing journals. You find it in, again, the Portland City Council. Portland has many, many other problems besides whether they are going to condemn Israel or boycott Israel or what have you. But this is frequently on their agenda. And I think one of the things that I continually emphasize is, and environmentalism is actually a good example, because, you know, BDS is part of a secular religion. It doesn't behave, it's not a movement. It's a series, it's not a series of organizations, it's a series of ideas. And the people who believe in BDS, who practice it like a religion. It's a religion with angels and demons, with a narrative of good and evil. And in a secularizing society like the United States, or a secular society like Europe, people still need religion. This is the bottom line. And in place of traditional religions, what we have in the last 30, 40, 50 years are a series of secular alternatives. And environmentalism is very much one of those. Now, so it doesn't surprise me that there's a strong crossover between people who not simply professionally are interested in environmental issues, but people who are emotionally invested in environmental issues, who are religiously invested in environmental issues, because people are religiously invested in BDS. People are religiously invested in anti-Semitism. And it has very, very little to do with Palestinians, per se. It has very, very little to do with, okay, let's have a Palestinian state, and how is it going to be constructed, and how are services going to be rendered? No, it has to do with angels and demons, and it has to do with sacralized entities, in this case the Palestinians, who are the new Jews in explicitly in the light of certain kinds of religious theologies and secular theologies. So the question is how to address that, and I don't really know, because again, one of the points that I always try and make is that our problems are nested within much, much larger problems, and that the religious orientation of the BDS movement is in part a manifestation or a byproduct of the larger secularization of society, where aimless people latch onto ideologies to give their lives meaning. And unless meaning can be found in other ways, they're still going to look for angels and demons. They're still going to look for a narrative of salvation somewhere. And it's part of it is going to be focused on condemning the devils of Israel, in this case, and its supporters, who are not coincidentally often Jews. Until we come up with some secular, some other kinds of religious alternatives, or until there's a larger return to religion, as has happened several times in the last 300 years, I think we're going to be confronting these kinds of problems of misplaced devotion. So in the meantime, with respect to media, I'll make yet another point that I always make. You cannot rely on one media source. You cannot rely on the so-called mainstream media. I don't mean to be dumping specifically on the New York Times, which is terrible on these issues, and it's terrible on lots of issues. You can't be, and it's not a corporate media issue. It's media as a whole. However one feels about this whole collusion business in the Mueller report, I don't think the media came out of it looking terribly good, because they were pushing narratives as opposed to reporting on facts and developments. So what one has to do is break away and look around, and there are lots and lots of places. For better and often for worse, these kinds of alternatives are in fact, or are labeled as conservative and right wing. And looking at these sources, and I'll give you an example. Facebook is the worst thing that's ever happened in the history of humanity. Period. I think we can all agree on that, except maybe for Twitter. But you know, when you start posting things on Facebook that are outside of the conventional range of your so-called friends, you're going to find out who your friends are. So I had a conversation with a real friend of mine who was very concerned about BDS, very concerned about these political issues, who's been a very passionate Democrat for years and years and years. And she's begun to look around at other kinds of media platforms and other kinds of depictions of the situation, and she's finding out who her friends are. And her so-called friends are kind of pissed off at her for going against the dominant narratives in which Israel is supposed to be, if not evil, then just not good, and where Netanyahu is a demon instead of just kind of a, you know, prime minister muddling along and doing good things and bad things, and so on. So there's a social choice, and there's a social cost. And there's a cost to becoming involved with these issues in your life and in your communities, virtual online communities and your communities every day, in terms of how you interact with people. As these things, as anti-Semitism and as BDS, become more important and more prevalent and more undisguised. And I think the American Jewish community, like the British Jewish community, is discovering that its position is very different from what it thought it was. And we will see how this plays out. I keep saying that. So.
Well, no, for sure. I mean, thank you for that. I mean, that's exactly the point. I mean, we are, all of us, Alex and I, you and I have been involved in this debate for a very long time, and we're seeing who the friends, you know, and learning about how all this metastasizes and materializes. But, you know, to your point, and something that, you know, you and I have written about, discussed for years, you know, is this newfound religiosity within all of this. And, of course, the demons and angels of the day, the vehicle is, of course, social media. And so that's, you know, clearly becoming, you know, how this all plays out, whether or not reality and fiction go hand in hand is a separate story, but this is exactly
right. And I think this is a new time, and I think that these three new members of Congress, Omar and Tlaib and Ocasio-Cortez, represent not it's a new kind of politics. It's an ideological politics. It's a religious approach to politics. Because they're uncompromising. They are focused on a narrow series of issues. They really, really dislike other people who have different viewpoints. And it's not about compromise. It's not about horse trading. It's not about getting bills passed. It's about making statements and looking pure and stamping your feet when you don't get your way.
Right. Well,
I don't think that's healthy.
No, not at all. I don't mean to scare, but I'm just trying to keep us. Be cognizant of people's time and everybody's time, and I wanted to make sure we're sticking to what we promised. So, really, Alex, as always, I want to thank you for all your enlightening remarks, and this conversation clearly is rich, ongoing. And of course, this will all be in our upcoming, in the forthcoming BDS monitor that will be coming out at the beginning of next week. And of course, there is a great deal to discuss. As always, I want to thank you, the audience, for joining us this afternoon, taking the time to listen, to express your views, comments, questions, and all. We are here for that. And so we welcome the conversation, and we hope you will continue to send us questions, comments, and join us for our next call. We hope to have one you know, after before Passover or Easter, after the Israeli elections, we'll look for another time to have another conversation. But with that said, really, I want to wish everybody good afternoon. Thank you again for joining us. Thank you, Alex, as always. And we will be in touch soon. Again, our email is bdsmonitor@spme.org. Please feel free to be in touch, and we will do the same. Thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.
Thanks very much. Take care, everybody.
Take care.